question relating to our parsha that's brought in the Sefer Olam Hamidos regarding the time that Yaakov is busy working in the house of Lavan. And as we know, he worked there 7 years originally for Rachel. Turns out it was actually Leah. And then he had to work another 7 years, contrary to what some people have the impression in school when you learn Parsha Vayetze as a kid. It wasn't 7 years marry Leah, then another 7 years marry Rachel. He came, approached Lavan when it turns out that it was the wrong wife, and says, "What do you mean? You tricked me. I want to marry Rachel." And Lavan's response was, "Okay, finish off of Sheva Brachos." This is, Yerushalmi says that this is a riot to Sheva Brachos. He says, "Malei Shavuos, finish the week. After the week of celebration of Leah is over, then you'll marry Rachel. Obviously, on condition that he's going to work another 7 years for Rachel." But the 7 years were not consecutive in that sense, meaning it was 7 years, married two wives, and then he married, and then he continued to work for another 7 years. Then he worked for a number of years after, another 6 years, which was unrelated to the marriages, but simply for extra hire. Yaakov was ready to leave, and Lavan said, "You might as well stay. Baruch Hashem, I've been very successful in your company. Please stick around a little longer." And that's when they make the deal with the spotted sheep and the striped sheep and everything that ultimately takes us to the end of the parsha. Quick, Jonathan?
Yeah.
I didn't say anything yet. Yeah.
So I know for the first 7 years is that it felt like the Torah goes out of its way to say that it felt like a couple of days because of his love for Rachel. But does that also apply to the 7 years after he got Rachel?
That's a good question. Let's see what Olam Hamidos says. Maybe he'll answer your question. Pasuk says that Yaakov worked for 7 years in anticipation of marrying Rachel, and it was in his eyes, just like a few days. It was just a few days. Out of the love that he had for Rachel, it felt like it was just a short time. Everyone asks, should have been just the opposite. Why did it feel like a short time for him? 7 years, right? When you're looking forward to something, it takes forever, right? Because you're anticipating, you're excited. So the clock is ticking very slowly. And here, it seems like there was the opposite phenomenon. Why should that be so? Should have been something that that Yaakov experienced as a very slow process. This is very interesting. He says, there's a principle of human nature, we'll say, that informs us as to the answer to this Shiloh. He says that in reality, when someone is working very hard for something, right, and he feels that he's working against his will, meaning there's a pushback and it's unpleasant and it's not what he wants to be doing, so then it takes a long time, right? If it's summer vacation and you're crossing off the days of your calendar, how many days of school are left? So because it's school and school's not exciting to me and I don't want to be in school, so then it feels like it's taking forever. If a person feels that at every step along the way, the actual effort that he has to put in and whatever tircha and whatever pain and struggle he experiences along that path is part of the tafkid and it's necessary in order to get to the end, then it'll go very quickly. If you feel like I'm sitting in class waiting for camp to start, so then there's nothing that correlates between school and camp, right? School is something I have to do. A, when I'm done with that, B, I'll go to camp and I'll have fun. But it's not that A leads to B. If you would just have a pandemic and cancel school for the rest of the school year, you could still go to camp when it's over, as long as there's no pandemic, right? But it's not that A leads to B. Because he was working to earn Rachel, as it were, so then he felt a value to each day, and A did lead to B. He did have to do A in order to reach B. He did have to work in order to merit marrying Rachel. And as a result, it felt like a short time. Even though he had to work with all of his strength, as he tells Lavan day and night, then it doesn't matter what the weather was, I always took responsibility, I never slept.
Because
So then you'll appreciate that the whatever rest you are able to enjoy along the way is for purpose of avodah, and not that the avodah is for the menucha, right? Think about that. Bein Hazmanim is coming up, right? So now you're a little more mature. You're not in sixth grade anymore. Now you're 20 years old, and you're working towards that vacation. So the question is, what is your attitude towards vacation? What's your attitude towards Bein Hazmanim? If Bein Hazmanim is freedom, okay, you know, finally I'm done. I don't have to sit in the basement all day. So just like the kid in school, there's A and there's B, but they're not related. It's just I got to get past A to get to B. However, if you see Bein Hazmanim as a chance to recharge and strengthen yourself, and it's servicing the hard work of being the base medrash, so then time will fly because you're getting to the menucha in order to then provide support and give you strength for the next time you can go back to the base medrash. Okay, and there's other examples that maybe will resonate with you more, but the point is that if I'm just trying to finish what I'm doing right now, but I don't see it as part of the journey, as a necessary stage in getting where I need to go, so then it's going to feel like a drag. I think there's a gilui over here. What the Olam Midas is saying is supported by the end of the pasuk, right? How's the pasuk go? He worked for 7 years for Rachel. Let's try to understand that better. Ba'avaso osa means he loved her a lot, right? So because he loved her, so time went quickly. 7 years is a long time. Because he loved her, time went quickly. So how did we answer the question? I thought you said the whole point was, if he feels like in the process he's leading to point B, so then it goes quickly. But again, the fact that the Torah emphasizes that, it doesn't say that he loved being a shepherd, right? Oh, it went by so quickly because he loved sheep. No, he didn't love sheep. He loved Rachel. So how does the end of the pasuk sort of flow from the previous part? If anything, it almost contradicts it. So the pshat's like this, everybody knows. Now, all of you have heard this many times, and I'm sure you'll continue to hear it. The trick is just to take it from the V'yadata Yom HaShivosa L'Vavecha, that the way that a person generates love and a relationship and cultivates it stronger and stronger is always through giving. Okay? And famously, many have pointed out, Ava is a lashon of Hav, which means to give. And the more that you invest in something, the more that you value it. The more you invest in a person, the more that person is special to you. So every day that Yaakov worked, Ba'avaso Osa, because he knew that by working out in the fields and taking care of the sheep, he was giving. He was giving 7 years of his life. But some guys complain we have to date for a few months. Okay? So he didn't have to date too much. He just walked up to the well and he found her. Okay? But he had to work for 7 years. Imagine someone having to date for 7 years. But he knew that investment was going to ultimately contribute to the connection and the depth and meaning of the bond between the two of them. So that's why it felt like a short time. Because it wasn't, oh, I'm out in the field, but I want to be home with my wife. It's, I know that the more I give to this project of being a shepherd, right, that deepens the love that I have for Rachel. And therefore, it went quickly because if he had to go to the store to buy a ring, it costs a lot of money to buy a ring, thousands of dollars to buy a nice ring, right? But there's an excitement. Why? Because the more I give, when I come in front of her and I propose to her and I show her that ring, right, it'll feel like $1 million. But the investment is worth it. So it doesn't it's not a strain. It's not a struggle. Same thing over here. That's what the pasuk is saying about Avasu Osa. That contributing to the love from the hard work made the time go quickly. Yeah.
I understand that for 7 years this union with Rachel, but 7 years is a long time. What makes him not think they're
wrong? So let's just to finish this ha'ara. So he continues with a beautiful point from Malkiel Cutler, the Rosh Yeshiva of Lakewood, who compares two pesukim. I think we mentioned this word before. On the one hand, in Parshas Nitzavim it says, Kikarov Eilecha Davar Ma'od. Kikarov Eilecha Davar Ma'od. It's very close to you. And many of the Parshim understand that means Torah. It's not so difficult, not so distant. Right? Pasuk also says, Lo B'Shamayim Hi. You don't have to go up to Shamayim in order to reach the Torah. It's Karov Eilecha Davar Ma'od. So the question is it really true? Is success and the ability to grow and reach godly Shul Torah, is that so simple to just say, oh yeah, it's easy. It's easy, just like go to school for a couple years, learn a few black gemara, and you'll be a world-class Talmid Chacham. Not true. So he gave the following mashal. We definitely mentioned this in Shir. He said, if I would say to you, there's a dollar free for the taking, and you just need to walk, it's about 15 minutes down the block, that, you know, straight up, 15 minutes, it's just sitting there, no one's going to take it. If you get there in a couple minutes, you'll be able to put it in your pocket, no strings attached. So you might say to yourself, you know, like 15 minutes for a dollar, I got other things to do, I got to go to class, I got to learn, I have to eat lunch. 15 minutes for a dollar doesn't sound too exciting. Sounds like it's far away. 15 minutes, that's too far away from me to justify going all the way for a dollar. However, if I said to you there was a suitcase with $1 million and you need to walk for 2 hours to get there, so you say to him, oh, only 2 hours? Right? You know, suddenly that distance, which is now much greater than the original distance, doesn't seem too far away because you have a hakara, you have an understanding of the value of what you're investing in. So that's what it means. It means that it has the potential to be very close to you and to have a sense that it's within reach, but it only comes if a person has generated within inside of himself the great value of Torah. If it's worth $1 million to you, you'll treat it with the same enthusiasm and you'll run with the same alacrity to get it, to work for it, because you put a price tag on it. If it doesn't have meaning to you, okay? So sometimes you go to yeshiva and someone gets excited about learning. It's not simply about, oh, I find Bava Basra so interesting and so intellectually stimulating. There are people who are turned on to that. And it's a wonderful thing. That who says that that's not of great value? It's a shalol lishma, maybe, but I remember when I told you this. I don't know if I told you this. When I started teaching Gemara first-timers, it goes back about 10 years ago, they hired me to give a shiur in a shul on the west side. People in their 40s who had never learned Gemara before. Some of them were Bali Tshuva. Some of them were people, maybe they went to yeshiva when they were younger, but, you know, never really connected with learning. And now they're in their 40s. Some of them are lawyers. There was a TV producer in the shiur. Very interesting guy. That venture capitalist with the air rights over Grand Central Station, Andrew Penson. Very chashuv yid. So all those guys were in the shiur, and they were just starting out. Some of them had a little more experience, some of them had less. But we were learning Makos, and they were just enthralled by the Kavachomers and the comparisons and this pasuk, how we read it, it's missing a word or that extra letter. Right? And suddenly the logic, the divine logic of Gemara that they've never been exposed to, they're very smart people, just sort of like sucked them in. And they were arguing back and forth without really having an understanding yet of the intricacies of all the Shas, but it was inspiring. Just, what, really? Like, the Chachamim had such a sophisticated way of analyzing every word in the Torah? Because if you're on the fringes, if you're on the sidelines, sometimes you learn a halacha, you hear the Torah, just sounds arbitrary, right? But when you get your feet, what's it called? You know, you get your hands or you roll up your sleeves and you get into it, it blows you away. That's why the Gedolim recommend, you know, all the different Kiruv methodologies that are out there. You know, there's so many ways to bring people in to an NCSY event or whatever, but in the end of the day, you sit down with a Gemara, you sit down with the wisdom of a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Sometimes that's the most powerful way to inspire someone. And it could take a while, but they'll appreciate the value of it, they'll appreciate the beauty of it, maybe on an intellectual level, but for you guys, I think your main avoda now is, over the time that you're here, to develop a love for learning and see how much it transforms me and how much it makes me a better person, how much it keeps me on track, how much that, you know, I just heard a fascinating insight. You don't have to recall the entire insight, but the crux of it is very critical. Someone asked, there's a chashuv rav in Lakewood. His name is Rabbi Gershon Ribner. And he has a Q&A, I think every Thursday night, maybe once or twice a week. And all types of people send in questions. I think it's primarily from the yeshivish camp, but sometimes the questions are from the yeshivish world, questioning things that are in the yeshivish world, not in an antagonistic, undermining fashion, but just try to understand, you know, when culture, Torah culture, contrasts with the world. And he asked, you know, why is it that we have this kolel culture, where there are thousands of people learning full-time, not making parnasa here in Eretz Yisrael. And it never was like this before the current generations, last couple decades. Torah learning full-time was never on such a grand scale. There always was, going back to Shevet Levi in Mitzrayim, there always was yeshiva, and there always were people learning full-time. They served Sif Sekon Yishmu Das, Torah Vakshim Yipiu. The role of Shevet Levi in the Kohanim was to be full-time engrossed in Torah, to share it with the rest of Klal Yisrael. Obviously, the good part, a couple weeks a year, they work in the Beis HaMikdash, but when they were not in the Beis HaMikdash, they were a Machanchim. They were Rabbanim, maybe Shevet Shimon also. Hold on, sorry. But it never was on such a wide scale across Klal Yisrael. And people are always asking, is it sustainable? Are we going to be able to pay for it, the next generation? All those questions aside, why is there this sudden, why did the Gedolim in America, let's say, deviate so profoundly from what in the shtetl, you barely had learned people. The Rav in town, hopefully, And there weren't always so, every town had a yeshiva. The best of the best from each town went to learn in the big yeshivas, in Mir, in Volozhin, in Baranovich, etc. So he answered, and I think you just need to digest it a little bit, and I'm not sure how it applies in every other society. But at least in America, it emerged in the 50s and the 60s and weiter to where it is right now. There was a major transition. Assimilation, why was it assimilation such a... So rampant in America. So obviously there are many explanations you can give. But one thing to keep in mind is that if you lived in Poland, in the old world, so your neighbors were essentially superstitious drunks. Right? We paint a picture of how things were like in their relationship between the non-Jews. But that was often the case. You had a parts, you had a landowner who would charge exorbitant prices to the simple farmers who lived on these lands, mostly to support their drinking habits and whatever narishkeit they spent their money on, and they were not educated, and they weren't sophisticated, and they just took advantage of the Jews in any way they could. So when you saw the non-Jews, rarely did you look up to them, right? Maybe in the big cities there were universities in Berlin, right? Germany was a little bit of a different emerging culture. Leading up to the Holocaust and earlier, but for a vast chunk of Judaism, especially in Eastern Europe, right? Russia, humongous, but really uneducated people, right? And drunk. So you had nothing to look up to in your neighbors. So it was easier to feel a value of Judaism and easier to feel committed to your Yiddishkeit because the rest of society wasn't so alluring. When people came to America, and there was this notion of the American dream, and we're going to get educated, and we're going to make a lot of money, we're going to move out to the suburbs, and we're going to have a comfortable life, and we're going to throw away all the oppression and all the disadvantages. I'm saying Jews and non-Jews alike, right? That was all the immigration to America. People wanted to leave that and begin a new life of success. So now, the culture that surrounded the Jewish communities was much more enticing. And therefore, what Rabbi Ribner was suggesting is that some of the Gedolim felt that it was more necessary than it was in previous generations to create a positive Torah culture. It's still not for everybody, but we needed a certain koach of the Kedusha of Torah to prevail in America in a way that we didn't need it to be a driving influential force in other societies that we lived in the past. Does it make sense, everybody? You hear it was a different demographic. So all of us, myself included, we need to reinforce within ourselves the value, the beauty of Torah, and how much it keeps me on track for the life that I want to lead, because then karov elecha davar me'od, it's going to be within reach. I'm not going to want to give it up. I'm not going to want to take an easy way out. I'm not going to want to switch to, add a BMP, whatever. It's going to make my life a lot easier. Okay, but you know what? I feel like I'm getting something here that I can't get anywhere else. Right? Why would anyone spend hours every night in the Beis Medrash? I went in 9 o'clock at night, Gluck Beis Medrash. I saw my friend Menachem over there learning with his Chavrusa. The Beis Medrash was alive and kicking, right? It was like the Kol Torah. 9 o'clock at night. Why would anyone do that? If you talk to your friends in secular colleges, they're like, what are you thinking? I wake up at 10, 11 a.m., yeah? And I can tell you what I'm doing, what I did the night before, that I woke up at 11 a.m. And again, I'm not saying it's about everybody, Baruch Hashem. There are fine Jews who are motivated and productive in other colleges as well. But we know, you talk to other people in other colleges, you don't always get the same rigors of the lives that you guys are leading, but you're doing it because you feel the great value of it. And the more that you reinforce that, the more it will stay with you and guide you and allow you to make the right decisions at every stage later on. Yes, Jonathan.
So just making sure that I'm understanding.
New topic over here, but it'll relate to this notion of the engine, of the people who are learning, the Koach HaTorah and Koach HaKadosh that keeps Klal Yisrael running. There's a very interesting attitude that we learn from the Avos, and it keeps revisiting, the Parshas keep revisiting this topic. You just have to catch it between the lines as you go from, let's say, last week's Parsha straight through for a few more weeks. And we'll kick it off with the very beginning of Parshas Toldos that we read last week. And Rivka is struggling to figure out what's going on inside of herself. Yeah? By his road to Abonim Bikirba, there's this royal rumble. And she's told, when she asks, the Nevi'im tell her that you have two nations inside of yourself and they're about to depart and go, each one go on their own individual path, and that will basically determine the course of history. But before that, all she knows is she walks by the base of Avodah Zarah, she walks by the base of Medrash, which is very confusing, right? But she knows there's a force of evil inside of herself. And she, it's painful, right? The pain that she's experiencing is what makes her ask in the first place, what's going on over here? And she, Rivka, as a very holy woman, had a tradition amongst the Imos that a woman who is a tzaddikess will never experience the pain of carrying a baby. And when she began to experience this pain, she was very curious. What does this mean? Right? And she thought it must be there's something wrong with her. Right? Something wrong with her. But that's exactly, she says, Lama Zanochi, but then why do I also have this rumbling when I pass the base medrash? She initially saw that, okay, there's some good, but there has to be some bad, and the bad must be sourced in me. And then she's put to rest. She's reassured, no, or her thoughts are put to rest. She's reassured, no, it has nothing to do with you, but there's this koach of ra inside of you. But it's not tied to you. That's not why you're experiencing the pain. But what do you see? This just lady points out. Her initial reaction when she was experiencing the challenge of having the babies inside of herself was there must be something wrong with me. And naturally, we have a response, almost a reflex, when something goes wrong, to look to blame someone else. A, because we're critical, but B, because emotionally, we don't want to be unsettled. We don't want to be insecure. And when I feel that I'm responsible for something going wrong, I need to shift the blame elsewhere. Otherwise, I feel that there's something uncomfortable on my shoulders, right? I bring you a rabbi. I'll say, tomorrow night, wherever you're going to be, hopefully you'll see Shabbos candles. Maybe you'll be lighting Shabbos candles in your own apartment or whatever. Think for a moment when you see those Shabbos candles about this idea. Because we know there's a number of reasons why we light Shabbos candles. One is to provide light, owning Shabbos, to add an elegant ambiance to my meal, but also to be able to the bright light adds to the pleasure of the day. No one wants to be in the dark. But there's another reason. What's the other reason for lighting the Shabbos candles? That's related, but that's an economy, that on a Kabbalistic level. But the simple, basic shot reasons. That's why we have two. That's why we have two. But it is covered Shabbos. The first thing I mentioned.
Right?
Shalom bias.
Because you need lights on, or people will be like freaking out.
So what does it mean, shalom bias? So the first one explained. You light the candles for shalom bayis because if the house is dark, and this applies to all rooms of your house, right? Even if you only light a couple candles in the dining room or whatever, but the more light, the merrier around the house. Because if you don't have lights on, so what's going to happen? I'm going to walk into the room, trip over some some toys or whatever kids left on the floor. What's my immediate reaction? Someone left something on the floor. Who left this here? Who forgot to clean up before Shabbos, right? That's my knee-jerk reaction, is to blame someone else. So shalom bayis, the candles teach you, no. Why don't you ask yourself, why didn't I clean this up before Shabbos? Right? It's a reminder that I need to take responsibility for myself also. Fast forward to the end of Parshas Toldos. Yitzchak Avinu realizes he gave the bracha to the wrong person. Esav comes in and he's yelling left and right. What happened over here? And what's Yitzchak's response? The pasuk says he cried out. He was petrified. Zakt Rashi, what was he petrified about? Yecharad, Charad Gedola. What was he afraid of? What does Rashi say? Kaizo and Rashi last week. He said to himself, maybe there was some aveira that I did that caused me to mess up big time like this and give the bracha to the wrong person. Rabosa, Yitzchak could have easily blamed it on Yaakov, or whoever it was who came in and tricked him. What was his knee-jerk reaction? Maybe I'm at fault. There's a godless to that. We can come up with so many other examples. We look at this week's Parsha, Rachel, when she's not having any children, and Leah's having lots of children, her immediate response, how she says, is, she must be a tzaddikus, I must be a Rasha, right? There's this, the meat of the avos is to first see my own responsibility before I shift the blame to someone else. Akilekach, my favorite part of this Parsha, and yes, I do have a favorite part of this Parsha, is at the very end, the transition between Shishi and Shri. Lavan finally catches up with his boys to Yaakov, and he has tainas. Why did you run away? Why didn't you tell me you were leaving? You escape in the dark of the night when I'm far away. And Yaakov goes on a whole tirade. Yaakov says, "Don't you know I've been working for years for you? I never got the appropriate appreciation. You changed my wages 100 times, and I had to work day and night. And if anything was lost, I took it out of my own pocket, and I worked honestly, and I worked hard." Right? On and on and on. How dare you come chasing me and accusing me of stealing your stuff? You checked through all of our tents. You didn't find a single thing. Yeah, again, Yaakov is a big tzaddik, but he's enough is enough. And he goes on for pasuk after pasuk after pasuk. And you know what Lavan says? The only thing Lavan says is, you know what? All these things, the kids are mine. The wives are mine. Everything is here. It's all mine. But I'm going to be nice to you, and I'm going to make a peace treaty with you. He doesn't even respond. He doesn't even have the... He isn't man enough to address the taina that Yaakov... He ignores it. He pretty much ignores it and says, you know, effectively, I take no responsibility for everything that you just blamed on me. Right? Total cheat, total liar. Doesn't take... But the avos... There, they look at themselves first and foremost before they look to blame somebody else. Okay. So this is something which can be applied in many areas of our lives, and I'll try to illustrate it with two episodes, one in Tanakh and one in real life. Which needs our attention for the midos value, but now also to get back to where we started, the Torah value as well. Is anyone familiar with Sefer Yonah for real? We know the story with the fish, but let's talk about it for real over here. Okay, there's an episode towards the beginning of the Sefer. They're on the boat, right? And there's a big storm, and they're trying to figure out what to do. Because it looks like everyone's going to die and the boat's going to go down. So everyone gets together, and there are people from all over the world. Chazal tell us there are representatives of all different faiths and all different countries. So they're desperate to stop the storm, and they say, okay, everybody get out your idol, pray to your God. They were bringing karbanos on the ship in the middle of the rain. They were doing everything they could, and nothing's working. And the master of the ship, the sailor, whatever, the captain, he's going around, and he discovers Yonah deep in the recesses of the ship, asleep. Everybody is doing everything they can. They're throwing things over the ship, over the side of the ship, and he finds this guy sleeping. And he's like, "What's the matter with you? How could you be sleeping at a time like this? How could you be sleeping at a time like this? Get up and daven, pray to your God." And what does Yonah say? Yonah says, "I know bishvili Hasara Hazos. It's all about me. You wanna know why I'm not being so I'm not taking the same approach? Because I know I'm at fault, I'm being punished." And he says, "You wanna test me? Watch. Hold me over the side." They weren't ready to, he looked like a man of God. They weren't ready to just dump him into water. That's what he wanted them to do, because he promised them, "You throw me into the water, it's all gonna subside and the water will be calm." So they weren't ready to do it. So they held him over and they like dipped his toes into the water. Like, and as they would like dip him in, like, you know, like the clouds parted and it was bright light and the rain stopped. And then they took him out and then the storm started again. Like, they knew it was him. He proved it to them. He said, "Bishvili Asarazos." Now, you're Yonah. He's a Navi. He's a man of God. Hashem spoke to him. And you're on a boat full of Ovdei Avodah Zarah from all over the world. This is like the International Convention of Idolatry. On this boat. And the boat is sinking. I'm a good firm Jew. I'm a Navi. It's their fault, right? And he identifies himself as such. And nevertheless, he says, "The blame is mine." He looks inside of himself. That's what a tzaddik does. Brisker Rav was once approached by some of his talmidim And they asked him, what do we do about all this Chol Shabbos? And this was in the early years of the Medina, where there was even in from areas, they were facing so much antagonism from the non-religious, from the anti-religious, and there was a constant clash. And what are we going to do? All the tsaris, it's caused by the chilonim, the machal Shabbos. Look at all they're doing to us. And the Briskov said, what about Yonah? What about Yonah? Who's asking? Who's looking inside of themselves and saying, what do we need to improve before we look and blame everybody else? And that brings us to the story I want to share with you. In 1991, when I was about 10 years old, it's when Eretz Yisrael was under attack. And I remember, even as a kid, there was a lot of tension. This is the Persian Gulf War. America went into Iraq and Kuwait to take out Saddam Hussein. I remember it was the first like real war. I hate to say it, but there's a desensitization. You hear that, Israel's going into Gaza, like, all right, again. Every couple of years we have to go in and fire a few missiles, kill a few Hamas leaders, unfortunately we lose Jewish lives also, but it's like every couple of years, like, all right, back together again, all right, ceasefire, no ceasefire, right? This was like a war. This was a war, and it was a war where, again, the first time in my life, the leader, the dictator, said, we are going to destroy Israel. And we are in range to fire missiles and chemical warfare to destroy the state of Israel. And, watching on TV, you guys haven't really seen this. Watching on TV, day in and day out, Jews wearing gas masks in the bomb shelters. And not just like in Ashdod, and not just in Netivot, Sderot, but like everyone across Israel they were locked in their rooms in their gas masks. Kids, older people, they were mission. They sent, I don't know, like 100, 200 people from YU just to go there to get a gas mask and sit in the shelters with people. Okay, obviously that was a halachic shaila. It was that way. There were a lot of people coming home. So there's so much tension. And Lemaisa, with all the threat and all the air raid sirens and all the times that we felt the impact, I think a grand total of one person died. All the missile attacks, one person died. They didn't have an Iron Dome back then. You know what they had? America provided Israel with Patriot missiles. Patriot missiles were, I guess, an early form of the Iron Dome automatically detects when there was, when the missile's coming. I think they had to, the Patriot missiles had to be shot one by one every time a missile came to shoot an Iraqi missile out of the sky. Saddam Hussein built a city, if I'm not mistaken, in Iraq. He named the city Tammuz 17. Listen to this, Rabosa. I'm sorry. Just you appreciate what's going on over here. I've got to read to you something, an article. In the fall of 2007, Saddam was... December 13, 2003, American forces had discovered Saddam cowering in a hole dug into the ground with an air vent and an extractor fan. The dictator who'd sworn he would fight to death and never be captured alive gave up without a fight. So we cover the newspapers. We woke up Shabbos morning. Shachar went into shul and he paskin, they should say challah without a bracha. On a visit to Mahmoudia, the name of one particular neighborhood in Iraq, talking about a certain member of the army who ultimately became from as a result of his experiences in Iraq, he came to a neighborhood that was named Tammuz 17. Jonathan Gross, who was this member of the United States Army, wasn't Jewish, wasn't from the time, asked his American comrade serving the area to the source of the name, but they didn't know. The next day, Jonathan asked one of the tribal leaders and received an astounding answer. The day of the 17th of Tammuz is a glorious day in our calendar, answered the sheikh. It's the day we conquered our enemies. Saddam built the neighborhood because he said we would conquer our enemies again, and he wanted us to have a place to celebrate when that happened. We'll say, Shavasar Batamas, 2,000 years ago, that's when more than 2,000 years, 2,500 years ago, that's when Nebuchadnezzar broke through the walls of Yerushalayim, the siege, to destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Saddam Hussein felt he was the reincarnation of Nebuchadnezzar. And Baghdad was the ancient Babel. And he was just doing it all over again. And he named a town, and I think he even inscribed the side of the missiles. The unit firing the Scuds at Eretz Yisrael was named Talmud 17. We were reliving the threat of the Churban. That's how people felt. That's how people felt. Meanwhile, January 25th, 1991 was the most devastating night for Eretz Yisrael during the first Gulf War. The story Rabbi Fran told over. 7 of Saddam Hussein's Scud missiles landed in the country, despite the Patriot missiles the United States had sent to intercept them, destroying nearly 150 apartments and damaging another 400. 150 apartments and damaging another 400. 2 of those Scuds landed in Ramat Gan, a neighborhood that is contiguous with Bnei Brak, with streets leading directly from one to another. One of Rav Shach's relatives, who was Rav Shach? Rav Shach was Rosh Yeshiva, a Ponovich. He died at about 104 or 106. He died maybe 20 years ago. So one of the relatives of Rav Shach visited him the next day and smugly noted that the Scuds had landed only in the less religious Ramat Gan, but not in the holy city of Bnei Brak. So he said, we have witnessed the fulfillment of the verse, this is what he said to Rav Shach, of I will separate the land of Goshen. Pasuk says, right? Kodesh Baruch Hu says, I'm going to differentiate between where the Mitzrayim live and where the Jews live, because the Makkah is going to hit here, it's not going to hit there. So Rav Shach said, my reaction was just the opposite. When the storm hit the boat that was carrying on Hanavi, each of the sailors began to pray to his idol. What did Yonah tell them? It's because of me that this great storm is upon you. Shouldn't Yonah have told them, if not for you and your idolatry, we wouldn't be in this mess? Why do you assume that the storm was due to his failure? You know what I think Rav Shach said? This is what a Gadol answers. You know what I say? The Scuds fell Friday night at 7 p.m.? Because at that time, on a January Friday night, rather than going to learn or reviewing the Parsha, people were sitting around and schmoozing at their tables. I think the Scuds landing at the time were a reminder to us in Bnei Brak that we weren't doing what we should have been doing. It's incumbent upon us to say, B'shaliyah Sarah Gadol Hazeh. It takes a Gadol like Rav Shach to flip around the circumstances. And instead of saying, oh, yeah, it fell in Ramat Gan where they're not so from, but not in Bnei Brak. Are you kidding? It wouldn't have fell in Ramat Gan if we were doing what we were supposed to be doing. So number one, there's a Midos lesson there. But our other lesson is also very true. The Koach HaTorah is what's keeping the rest of the car running. The engine, the Kedusha that's generated by those who are learning Torah, you right here in this room, is what's keeping, forgive me, I didn't say this, Rabbi Shlomo Salanter said this, it's keeping your friends in secular colleges from. You have an achrayus, if they're not learning, your Koach HaTorah, have them in mind. Your Koach HaTorah is going to keep them from. And maybe it'll make a relative of yours who isn't from. Religious. Because of the Koach HaTorah that you're generating when you're in the Beis Medrash. That's also why we need kolos. That's also why we need people who are fully dedicated so that the vast expanses of Klal Yisrael will one day come back. And even those of us who are from will be inspired, will be connected. Why do they take a kol and plant it down in a community where there's already a shul? Oh, we already died. We already learned. No! We need to generate more Kedusha to make people even more connected, to feel Hashem's presence everywhere we go. That's the lesson. That's the lesson of Shevet Levi. That's the lesson of the Koach HaTorah. And the more that we appreciate, Jonathan, that's all answering your question. Yeah. That's also the Pshat. Not just more education, but also, and not just raising the bar of the appreciation, but also because we need the motor to keep running stronger and stronger, to keep the rest of Klal Yisrael moving towards Mashiach. Okay, so we'll stop there.